And the Blessed One, together with a large company of bhikkhus, went to the further bank of the river Hiranyavati, to the sala grove of the malas, in the vicinity of Kusinara. And there he spoke to the Venerable Ananda, saying, "Please, Ananda, prepare for me a couch between the twin sala trees, with the head to the north. I am weary, Ananda, and I want to lie down." "So be it, Lord." And the Venerable Ananda did as the Blessed One asked him to do. Then the Blessed One lay down on his right side in the lion's posture, resting one foot upon the other, and so disposed himself, mindfully and clearly comprehending. At that time, the twin sala trees broke out in full bloom, though it was not the season of flowering. And the blossoms rained upon the body of the Tathagata and dropped and scattered and were strewn upon it in worship of the Tathagata. And celestial Mandarava flowers and heavenly sandalwood powder from the sky rained down upon the body of the Tathagata and dropped and scattered and were strewn upon it in worship of the Tathagata. And the sound of heavenly voices and heavenly instruments made music in the air out of reverence for the Tathagata. And while that was going on, there was a monastic named Upavana who was standing there in front of the Buddha, beautifully, gently fanning him. And the Buddha said, "Would you move out of the way?" And Ananda thought, "Gee, you know, that's a little harsh. Upavana only means well. He's trying to help. And I wonder why the Buddha was not more sensitive to him." So Ananda asked the Buddha about this. And the Buddha said, "Well, I had to ask him to move because there's a lot of little devas flying around in the air. The whole sala grove is full of little devas flying around. There are so many of them that you cannot touch the point of a hair anywhere without touching a little deva flying around. And these devas have been grumbling and complaining. They've been saying, 'Gee, you know, we came all the way here to see the wonderful and rare sight of a Buddha leaving this world. And now here's this big lumbering monk standing in the way, so we can't see what's going on.' And that is why," the Buddha said, "I asked Upavana to move." And Ananda said, "Well, I can't see any devas. What kind of devas are there around here?" And the Buddha said, "There are sky devas and earth devas, all kinds of devas, all over the place, weeping and tearing their hair and throwing themselves onto the ground in grief." Ananda then asked the Buddha about funeral arrangements, as one does, you know, person is dying, last thing in the world they want to think about, but you have to find out, you know, what would you like? And the Buddha said, "Ananda, you monastics have your job cut out for you. You have to strive for awakening, tirelessly strive, and you don't have time to be arranging funerals. You should leave that up to the various classes of lay people who are devoted to me. They will take care of the funeral. But what should we do with the remains then?" Ananda asked him. And he said, "You should treat my body just as you would treat the body of any ordinary king. You should wrap it in a cloth of 500 layers thick with cotton and put it in a big iron vat, and then make a big funeral pyre and use all kinds of perfume mixed in with the wood, and burn the body and raise up a stupa for the ashes in a crossroads shrine. So, having heard all this and knowing that he knew whatever was to be known practically for the arrangements, Ananda walked away by himself to his own lodging, and he leaned on the doorpost and lamented, "What am I going to do?" he thought. "I know I'm not awakened yet, and now my teacher is leaving me. What am I going to do?" And knowing that Ananda was thinking this, the Buddha called him back and he said, "Ananda, you know that death comes to everyone. Don't worry." And then he said to the other monks who were assembled there with them, he said to them, "Every Buddha in the past has had an Ananda, just like Ananda. And every Buddha who will ever live in the future is going to have an Ananda, just like Ananda. And Ananda has four remarkable qualities. When people come to see him, they are pleased, just looking at him," because, you know, Ananda was very handsome. People were happy just when they looked at him. "Second, when Ananda talks Dharma to them, that also makes them very pleased and happy. Third, when he doesn't talk Dharma to them, they're disappointed." It seems like the Buddha forgot the fourth thing, because there is no fourth thing in the text that I could figure out, even though he said there were four things. I could only find three things. I mean, I looked it over, up and down. There's only three things I could find. Anyway, it's interesting that the Buddha is not consoling Ananda, as we might think, saying to him, you know, "Don't worry." The Buddha could have said, you know, "Don't worry, I know that on, you know, January 20th, you're going to awaken." He could have told him that. He didn't say, you know, "Don't worry, you're going to find other teachers." Instead, he told him that he is, as he is now, already special and perfect, and that forever, throughout the whole of the past and the future, the unique role of being himself has always and will always exist just as it is right now, and that people will always love him and be delighted to see him and to hear him. Then the Buddha told Ananda to go into town where the Malas lived and tell them that that very night, in the last watch of the night, that the Buddha will attain Parinibbana. And so Ananda told them, and they all, hearing that, came around by the sal grove to wait, have a vigil for the end. And at that point shows up another ascetic wandering around called Subhadda, who had heard about the Buddha's passing and thought, "Oh, I better get there pretty quick. The Buddha's a wonderful teacher and I really want to receive teaching from the Buddha." So he shows up, and Ananda tried to tell him, "Well, maybe this is not a good time, you know, maybe not now." But the Buddha overheard them talking and said, "No, no, no, this is the perfect time. Have him come." And Subhadda came, and he and the Buddha had a little chat. And Subhadda was so moved by his discussion with the Buddha that he said, I wish that I could have ordination." And Ananda said, "Well, you know, you have to wait. There's rules and regulations about this," and so forth. And The Buddha said, no, don't worry about all that. And so this guy, Subhadra, was ordained right then and there on the Buddha's deathbed. He was the last of the Buddha's disciples. Then the Buddha asked, is everything clear? Are there any final questions? And nobody said anything. And the Buddha could see that there were no questions. Everyone actually knew exactly what to do. So he then said to them, all conditioned things are of the nature to pass. Strive on untiringly. And those were his last words. Those were the last words he ever spoke. Then the Buddha entered the first jhana, the first concentration state, from which he entered the second concentration state, the third and the fourth. And after that, he passed into the concentration state of infinite space, then concentration of infinite consciousness, then the concentration of nothingness, and then the concentration of neither perception nor non-perception, at which Ananda said, the Buddha has passed away. But the great Anuruddha, who was also there, said, no, Ananda, the Buddha hasn't passed away. Then the Buddha went backwards from the concentration of neither perception nor non-perception to the concentration of nothingness and so on, back down through the eight jhanas to the first. And then he went forwards again, intensifying conversation from the first jhana to the second jhana, to the third jhana, to the fourth jhana, and from the fourth jhana, the Buddha leaped free of this sad and limited world, at which there was, as you could imagine, a tremendous earthquake. Boom! Thunder rolling. Huge, dramatic stuff. And after that, various gods and the distinguished monastics recited verses to mark the occasion. It's interesting that the sutra goes through this detailed explanation, because how does anyone know exactly what state of mind the Buddha was in, you know, when he was passing? How could anybody know this? On the other hand, Anuruddha was quite famous for his, you know, supernormal powers. He was a super great meditator. So I guess we are to assume that Anuruddha actually could tell exactly what state the Buddha was in at any given moment. Notice that when the Buddha entered the neither perception nor non-perception concentration state, the eighth jhana, Ananda looked at him and thought he just died. Because in that meditation state, breathing stops and a person appears as if they're dead. There's no perception. There's basically no sign of life. That would also explain what we read yesterday, how someone could be meditating so intently that 500 carts could rumble by and they wouldn't even know it because they didn't perceive anything. Or the whole earth could be shaking and thunder could be rolling and they wouldn't perceive anything. As you probably know, these eight jhanic states are mentioned again and again and again throughout the Pali Suttas. And in many places, they're defined in more or less detail. Earlier in this sutra, there is a little part where they are discussed and defined briefly. I didn't mention that part earlier. It's earlier in the text. And probably we've been sitting here this week long enough so that many of you have entered various concentration states. Probably some of you have coursed in one or more of the jhanic states. These states, in a word, you know, they're understood to progress in greater and greater subtlety. The first ones have some quality of pleasantness and bliss and feeling of lightness in the body that you can enjoy and know, and your mind can perceive. But as the states deepen, they go beyond enjoyment, beyond knowing, to a state of no thought or no particular emotion, just deep equanimity, all the way to infinite space and consciousness and nothingness, and finally, no perception, a state that appears almost like death, but isn't. When Dogen calls Zazen Shikantaza, Shikan is concentration, insight, at all in the same practice. So in our practice, we are not trying to develop these eight concentration states. So for us, they just pop up occasionally, maybe, spontaneously, not sequentially. There's some debate in the tradition about how much concentration is actually necessary to transform our life, which is the point. It's not concentration, but transformation of our lives. How much concentration is necessary for that? As we've studied earlier, a certain amount is necessary, but how much? And could there be too much concentration? Could it become counterproductive? So I think, as we know, concentration practice can be a wonderful adventure and a great exploration. But I could see where too much of that and too much interest in that could be not so good. And in our practice, we don't emphasize concentration greatly. And so we don't create an atmosphere of strong pressure in which one would be encouraged, almost forced into powerful concentration states. Anyway, you might have expected, wouldn't it be logical, that the Buddha would enter Parinirvana through the portal of the deepest of all the concentration states, wouldn't you think? But no, he enters through pretty much the middle, before the deepest states. So you might wonder, did he have to go all the way to the deepest states and then come back before he entered? And then you could wonder further, did it really happen that way at all? Was this a later addition? Like Morris Walsh says, there definitely are all kinds of, they monkey with the text a lot, you know. In Mahayana sutras, there aren't just eight jhanas, there are infinite jhanas with various exotic names. So if this week you have been enjoying some concentration states, it's possible that you have not that much been enjoying the jhanic states, but you've been enjoying some Mahayana concentration states with names like Great Luminous Moon Concentration, or Endless Light and Heavenly Trembling Concentration, or Great Fragrant Mandarava Flower Petal Concentration, or some other kind of concentration like that. We have this word state, you know, mental state or state of mind or something like that, which implies somehow, state implies some steady, recognizable experience that lasts for some time, and sometimes it happens like that. You might have some pleasant state of mind that lasts for 1 hour or 5 minutes or maybe a day or two. As we also know, you can be in total misery for quite a while too, but that's probably not one of the concentration states. That's probably just you, you know. But sometimes, you know, these, you can have something that lasts a little while, and that's very pleasant and wonderful. But sometimes, actually, technically, these concentration states last only a flash of a flash of a moment. Maybe all this that was described in the sutra happened in the Buddha's life, maybe in 1 second, you know, all boom, 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 1 second. And you don't even notice. Anyway, I guess the main thing here is that the Buddha was familiar all his life, like a lot of us also are familiar, with various kinds of states of mind and concentration states, so that when he was leaving the world, naturally he entered into these familiar states beyond consciousness and object, finally. And I've often felt that it's so odd that sesshin, which is so troublesome and expensive and painful and boring and difficult and frustrating. I mean, I can't think of a worse fate. You know, somebody didn't want to be doing this, they had no idea what we were doing, and they didn't want to be doing it, they had. And then somebody came in and made them do this. This should be like punishment for prisoners, you know, to have to do this. Worst thing. It's really, you know, troublesome and all that. And yet, we keep coming to sesshin. We love sesshin. And I have to believe, and I think it's, and I know it's true actually, that we love it because besides all of that other stuff, which goes along with it, it's a beautiful and wonderful experience. And the wonder and happiness of sesshin, those of us who are always at sesshin every year many times, the beauty and the wonder and the happiness of sesshin is actually far greater than ordinary happiness. You know, people who don't know this kind of happiness, it's too bad, you know, they're missing some wonderful way of being human. So much more subtle and beautiful, and so much simpler, the pleasure and beauty of sesshin. So, given that we know this from our own experience, we can only imagine that even if the Buddha had some difficulty in his passing, and the sutra doesn't say that he had any difficulty, but even if he did have some difficulty, probably he was very happy and peaceful, and felt maybe a greater ease and joy than he had ever felt in his life. And his last moments were beautiful moments. It's interesting and sort of ironic that he tells Ananda that it is not for monastics to worry about funerals, that this is the problem for lay people. As you might know, all around the Buddhist world, especially in Japan, priests are known for doing funerals and in general for being the people who take care of death. People tell me that in Japan, they say that you go to the Shinto priests for the joyful things like weddings and births, and you go to the Buddhists for all the depressing things like dying and serious illness and memorial services and stuff like that. So, people do not welcome the sight of a Buddhist priest. Uh-oh, here comes the priest. I must be close to death now. He's coming. Uh-oh. Let's not call the priest. Get the priest away from here, you know. So, it looks like in these cultures, the Buddha's recommendation that the monastic should not be involved in funerals has not been followed. There's something good, I think, about Buddhists taking care of death, because death is important. and profound and without our recognizing what death is, we can't really live a full life. But I can see why the Buddha said that. I can see there's something not so good about it. They say that in Japan, the so-called funerary Buddhism is slowly coming to an end as social customs change. And in Japan, for some generations now, taking care of death has actually been the main function of Buddhism and its main support. Not that much practice, but lots of funerals and memorial services. In our practice, we also take care of death. When someone dies, if it's right, if we're invited, if it's okay with the family, we sit with the person as they are dying, and we sit with them after they are dead, and we help to wash the body and get it dressed, and we open up the window, and we get a fan, and we put flowers and herbs so that we can sit with the body for a while, one day or more than one day, and provide space for friends to come and visit. Since we have gotten used to death, we can sit there and make it okay, safe for others to come and say goodbye. Maybe we're sitting there out loud or in our mind, chanting the Heart Sutra mantra, Gate Gate Paragate Parasangate Bodhisvaha, over and over and over. Or maybe we're chanting the Dahishin Dharani. Sometimes we even chant the full moon ceremony with the resolution of karma and the refuges, the summoning of the bodhisattvas to help the person cross over. Sometimes, while we're doing all that, the room fills up with sky devas and earth devas so thick you can't even touch the end of a hair without touching one of these devas. And they're usually crying. And sometimes we're crying too. And it's a very quiet and strong time if you're fortunate enough to have that time with a friend. And then when the time comes, we go to the crematorium for a brief service as we commend our friend's body to the furnace, and we say goodbye a second time, more chanting, more offering incense, more tears. By now, the devas have been going on to other subjects, other things, they're not around anymore. It's just us human beings. And then sometime later after that, we have a funeral service and we carry the ashes into the Dharma hall. We place them on the altar with a picture of the person and the person's name and other things from their life that were dear to them. And we make Dharma statements and we wave a flame around while the drum is being played to crescendo to indicate that we are now bringing the karmic energy of this lifetime to a close. We offer precepts, we chant, we take the time for family members and important friends to address the person who has died and to say to them, thank you, I love you, you are so special, there has never been anyone quite like you, there never will be again. And we wish the person well on their endless bodhisattva journey. And so we say goodbye a third time. And then sometime after that, more quietly, we have a small ceremony, usually just a few people there, to scatter or bury the ashes. At San Francisco Zen Center, Green Gulch, Tassajara, we have a Buddhist cemetery for monastics and abbots where ashes are interred. But mostly people scatter ashes. And a lot of people, in our local Sangha have come to our house. We live on a cliff over the ocean, so they come to our house to scatter ashes. And we chant and we strike bells and we scatter the ashes into the sea. It's windy up there. So a lot of times the wind is blowing and the person's ashes blowing all over my robe. This robe is just full of the ashes of I don't know how many people. Our house is becoming quite a cemetery. And that way we say goodbye for the fourth time. But we never stop saying goodbye. Maybe each year on the anniversary of the death, we light incense and a candle and we chant a sutra for the person. When someone we love dies, we never, ever forget them. And after a while, it dawns on us, they are still alive in us. They actually, literally, are living in us, through us. And as long as we will be alive, that person will be alive. As long as we will love them, they will be alive. And they will continue their bodhisattva work through us. When someone dies particularly close to you, you must ask yourself, what work did that person do in their life that because they're gone, they can no longer do, and so I must do it? And I haven't told it in some years, but for 5 or 6 or 7 years after the death of my dearest friend and colleague and spiritual partner, Rabbi Alan Liu, after he died, for years I told a story of myself asking, what did he do that he can no longer do and that I now must do? And I realized that what he did was to practice compassion and caring. He was so compassionate and caring, and I realized I was not that compassionate and caring. I was too busy writing a poem. Don't bother me, I'm busy writing a poem. Or reading a book, you know, get out of the way, I'm reading a book, can you see? I'm busy. Or I was busy, you know, complaining about something, usually the San Francisco Giants. And I realized, you know, I'm supposed to be, you know, a Zen Buddhist priest, a Mahayana Buddhism priest, and I'm really not, like, too swift on compassion. So now I really have to practice compassion, because he can't do it anymore, in his name and in his memory. And that's when I started to really focus my efforts on the compassion teachings, so that at least I could try, and I'm trying. So probably this will happen to you too. Maybe someday you'll have to do something on behalf of your loved one, for that person, and as it will turn out, also for yourself. So after the Buddha died, the Malas honored his body in the sal grove with singing and dancing and music and flowers for a solid week. They had a party for a whole week right around the Buddha's body. And on the seventh day, the chiefs of the Malas said, I think we've honored the Buddha enough with song and dance, and now we should carry the body through the southern gate to a secluded place for burning. But when they tried to lift up the body, they couldn't lift it up. And they were confused, so they went to Anuruddha, and they said, why is that? And he said, it's because you have your intention, but the Devas have a different intention. And the chief said, well, what is their intention? And Anuruddha said, they think you should not carry the body out the southern gate to the secluded place. They think you should carry the body out of the northern gate and all through the city. And so they tried to do that, and sure enough, they could pick up the body and carry it, and through the city there was more dancing and singing and hurling of flowers. And then when all that was over, they got to where they could deal with the Buddha's body as they had been instructed. Now, while all that was going on, elsewhere, some miles away, Mahakashyapa, who was the Buddha's leading disciple, was traveling with a company of 500 monastics who were his disciples. And he just so happened to be coming toward Kusinara. And along the way, he met a monk who was carrying a beautiful flower, and he asked him, where was that flower from? And the monk said, this flower was from the observations for the passing of the Buddha. Oh, Mahakashyapa didn't know that the Buddha passed. And when he told it to all the 500 monastics, they started weeping and wailing and full of grief, and they were totally freaked out. And he said, Mahakashyapa said, didn't you hear what the Buddha's been saying all this time? Why all this? Meanwhile, back in Kusinara, it was time to light the funeral pyre. So they made a big fire and they tried to light the funeral. Would it light? Funeral pyre, nothing would light it. So the Mala chiefs went to Anuruddha and they said, what's going on? And Anuruddha said, well, you have one intention and the Devas have another intention. And so they said, what's the Deva's intention? And Anuruddha said, well, the Deva's intention is that you can't light the funeral pyre until Mahakashyapa shows up and pays homage to the body of Buddha. So they waited. And in a little while, I don't know how long, Mahakashyapa came with his 500 disciples and he immediately circumambulated the body of the Buddha. And when he was finished, the funeral pyre spontaneously burst into flames. After the Buddha's body was all burned up, many rulers and leaders of different communities came and patiently explained why it was that their place, their community, was the one best place, the rightful place for the stupa, which would contain the Buddha's ashes. Each one came in turn and made a speech about this. So in the end, they divided the ashes into eight equal parts, and eight different stupas were erected in eight different places, which is one advantage of cremation, you know. You can divide the ashes. They say that you can't be in more than one place at one time.
Just have to die first.
Yeah, if you die, you can be in a lot of different places, right? So, for instance, Suzuki Roshi's ashes are interred at Tassajara, up at the ashes site, a short hike from the monastery up the hill, under a great huge triangular memorial stone that they managed to get up the hill. But also his ashes are interred at Rinso Inn, in his family temple in Japan. And it's a nice thing if there's a place where you can go and feel the presence of a departed loved one, some kind of pilgrimage place. Before he died, earlier in the sutra, I didn't mention this before, but earlier in the sutra, the Buddha said that if people wanted to seek his presence, they could go to the place where he was born, the place where he awakened, the place where he entered Parinirvana, and his presence would be in those places too. But we know, too, that those are good places to visit, and maybe some of you have visited those places, but we know that if we want to find the Buddha's presence, we actually don't have to go to India or Nepal, because we learn from Dogen that the Buddha's presence, not theoretical presence, but actual presence, is everywhere on every atom of space, and it is certainly there to be felt on your meditation cushion. So when I first got into the talking about this Parinirvana Sutra, I said that I would find a passage from the Mahayana Nirvana Sutra to quote for you. So I found one. I'll quote it for you now. This is also, as this just before the Buddha is entering Parinirvana. As often happens in the Mahayana Sutra, lengthy discussions take place between various bodhisattvas asking various questions. They can go on for some time, these discussions. So just before he's entering Parinirvana, Buddha has a discussion lasting many volumes with various people. So here he is in dialogue with the Bodhisattva Kassapa. At that time, the world-honored one once again addressed Kassapa, saying, "Good man, the body of a Tathagata is a permanently abiding body, an indestructible body, an adamantine body. It is not a body sustained by food of any sort. In other words, it is a Dharma body." And the Bodhisattva Kashyapa said to the Buddha, "World-honored one, I do not see anything like the bodies that you have just enumerated. All that I can see is a body that is impermanent, destructible, made up of atoms, which consumes different kinds of food, and so forth. And why is that what I see only? Because I'm seeing you right in front of me, ready to enter nirvana, and that's what I'm seeing." And the Buddha said, "Now, Kasyapa, you must not say that the Tathagata's body is not solid. You must not say that it is subject to destruction like the body of an ordinary person. Good man, you should be aware of the fact that the body of a Tathagata has become hardened and difficult to destroy over an immense period of time, hundreds of millions of kalpas. It is not like the body of a human or even a god. It is not a body bound by fear, nor is it a body that consumes any kind of food. The Tathagata body is a body, and it's not a body. It wasn't born, and it will not cease to exist. It doesn't learn, and it doesn't practice. It's immeasurable and boundless. It leaves no footprints. It doesn't discern things and has no forms to discern. It's utterly pure. It has no movement. It's neither passive nor active. It's non-abiding and non-becoming. It's unflavored, unmixed. It wasn't created. It has no karma and no karmic fruit. It doesn't move. It doesn't disappear. It's not a thought. It's not a number. It's inconceivable, and it will always be inconceivable. It has no consciousness in the usual sense. Its thoughts are impartial, neither separate nor non-separate. It is not, and it is. It has neither coming nor going, and yet it does come and go. It cannot be destroyed, damaged, removed, or cut off. It does not come into existence, and it does not go out of existence. It does not dominate, and yet it is dominant. It is not being, and it is not non-being. It is not realized, and it is not observed. It cannot be put into words, and yet it is not non-linguistic. It is neither definite nor indefinite. It cannot be seen, yet it is clearly visible. It is without any location, and yet here it is. It is without any residence, and yet it resides. It is without darkness and without light. It has no quiescence, and yet it is quiescent. It possesses nothing. It does not receive, and it does not give. It is pure and without stain. It has no disputes, having cut off all disputation. It resides without any place of residence. It neither takes nor falls into samsaric existence. It is neither a dharma nor a non-dharma. It is neither a field of merit nor not a field of merit. There is no exhausting it. It cannot be exhausted. And it is totally separate from all ways that anything could ever possibly be exhausted. It's empty. And yet dissociated from emptiness. Although it does not permanently reside anywhere, there is no cessation of its thought stream. It has no stains. It is without words, existing apart from words. It is not voice, it is not speech, and it does not learn. It does not weigh, and it does not measure. It is neither unified nor differentiated. It is neither an image nor a characteristic, though it is adorned with external characteristics. It is neither bravery nor fear. It has no quiescence. It does not become quiet. It has no heat. It does not warm. It is not visible. It has no external form. A Tathagata saves all living beings, and yet does not save anyone, which is why he is able to liberate living beings. That is not the end of the passage by a long shot. But I just wanted to give you a flavor of how that sutra reads. So, we have had a strong session this week, an important time for all of us, and especially an important time for many of us. And as always, I want to thank each and every one of you for your devoted practice, for your struggles. It inspires me, it keeps me going. So I close my Dharma talks of this week with one last word. Somebody mentioned this to me in the Dokusan room, and I totally forgot about this. I used to say this all the time. You know, Zen teachers have like famous sayings that they say all the time. But I don't have that because I forget what my famous sayings are. So just when I'm getting good at saying the same thing over and over again, something else happens and I forget about it. So I totally forgot about this one. It's a very good one, though. So that's why I'm going to tell you now. Three things. So this is what I want to leave you with, okay? This is what it all amounts to. Everything that all week just amounts to these three little things. First, be humble. This doesn't mean, you know, be self-effacing. You know, think you're the lowest person. Doesn't mean that. It means know who you really are. Know what you really are. Let go of thinking you're a great person or a terrible person or a middle person or any kind of person. Just answer when your life calls you. Don't run away. Be humble. Second, see everyone as Buddha. This doesn't mean just be nice and kind and polite to everyone, although I hope you will be nice and kind and polite to everyone. It means much more than that. It means literally, actually, to see that all beings are impermanent, suffering beings, even inanimate things. As they are actually, truly, as they appear right now, Buddha. There's nothing more that's meant by the word Buddha than that. So when you find yourself angry and dismissive of someone or something, remember this point. And three, try to help. Just try to help. simply in whatever way that you can. And sometimes sitting is good help. Sometimes saying a prayer is good help. Sometimes just witnessing with love when there's nothing else to be done is good help. So that's what I've been really trying to say all week. Somebody, thanks whoever reminded me. Be humble. See everyone as Buddha. Try to help. Thank you.